Grow in your faith. At Seton Hall's Immaculate Conception Seminary School of Theology, you can earn a degree or certificate in theology, pastoral ministry, and more. Learn how at theology.shu.edu.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Tim Drake talks with moral theologian and cultural analyst Dr. Pia De Seleni on Time Magazine's pronouncement that the pro-life movement is winning. Have you heard about this? We're going to find out if that is indeed the case and why. In our second half, Tim talks with National Catholic Register film critic Stephen Gray Donis about some of his favorite films of the past year. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Tim Drake, senior writer for the Register. Hello again, Tim.
It is good to be with you, Tom.
And with you, my friend. You know, this may be hard to believe, but Time Magazine's recent cover story declared that the pro-life movement is winning. To find out if that is indeed the case and why, we'll be talking today with Dr. Pia De Seleni. Pia is a moral theologian and cultural analyst. She has addressed these issues on radio, television, and in various publications. Dr. De Seleni received her doctorate in sacred theology from the Pontifical University of the Holy Cross. She received the 2001 award of the Pontifical Academies from Pope John Paul II for her doctoral work. Pia, a pleasure to have you with us today on Register Radio.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
So, Pia, this is Tim, and I have sort of this million-dollar question. And Planned Parenthood has opened its largest abortion facilities ever, and there have been no successful challenges of Roe v. Wade. And we continue to abort approximately 4,000 preborn children each and every day in this country. So I wonder, from your perspective, is it possible to look at that and say, as Time Magazine has, that the pro-life movement is winning?
You know, call me a cynic, Tim, but I don't think we're winning. I think we're doing a lot of good work. I think there are a lot of good people that are sacrificing a lot. I think there have been some great state legislation passed, but I don't think that we're winning. I look at the last election, and we have a presidential candidate that ran on values, on the value of abortion, and he won. We have Planned Parenthood, which has just released its annual report. They now, this past year, they received $542 million in taxpayer funding. They are economically, financially, they're set. I mean, maybe they could be advising the federal government because they seem to know how to run their finances. We have over a million abortions a year. I don't think we're winning. I think we have a lot of work to do. I think we have a lot of good people out there working and a lot of good initiatives underway, but I don't think it's a clear-cut win.
So that then, you know, begs the question of why Time would position the article in this way, and really the question there I have is, are they really just trying to drum up support for their base? You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, again, I said at the beginning that I'm a cynic, and I would say that, yeah, I think they're trying to drum up base for their support. We used to joke in D.C. that the best way to gin up your fundraising is to lose an election. If your issue or your candidate, your party loses an election, it's really easy to raise money because you have a cause that's just about to be lost. You just lost an election, and all you need is some money. You need somebody's cash, and if somebody sends that, that cause that's just about to be lost won't be lost. And right now, I think a lot of donors to abortion causes are saying, well, wait a minute, it looks like you're in pretty good shape. You're getting funding. You've got a president that supports you that just won on your issue. There are over a million abortions a year. What's the crisis? And so I think that there had to be some sense of a crisis. And look at the timing, too. I mean, this article came out just before Planned Parenthood's 2011-2012 annual report, in which it looks to me like they're doing a really... They're meeting all of their goals. I think their board was probably very, very happy with this annual report.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about where there is success, because as you indicated, there are good initiatives. And while we might say that the pro-life movement isn't winning, there is a lot of good work that is being done. And I'm wondering, you know, in those areas where there is success in the pro-life movement, where you see that and to what you would attribute the successes that are there.
I would say there's probably three areas. One is in state legislation. I think we have some really smart people that are working at the state level to pass very reasonable legislation, and legislation that is based primarily on the principle of women's health. We need abortion clinics to be regulated so that we know that they're safe. If women are going in there, I mean, at the very least, we want them to be receiving a safe procedure. Not going to be safe for the baby, but at least for them. Secondly, we have the pregnancy help centers or the pregnancy medical clinics. I just think that they are the backbone of the pro-life movement. And just as a disclaimer, I'm on the board of Heartbeat International, so it is a passion of mine. Mm-hmm. But I think this is really where the rubber hits the road. This is where we see the pro-life movement really stepping up. Here's, you know, it's woman after woman after woman who feels as if they have no choice but to have an abortion. And the pro-life movement is there to help them and to show them that actually you do have choices. And we're going to be here to help you make these choices and to give you some real choices. And then I would say the third is just general awareness, and I really give a lot of credit, I think, to people who are involved in different prayer initiatives, things like 40 Days for Life. It is a public witness. It's a very gentle and subtle public witness. Most of the time it's not covered in the secular media, but it's a wonderful witness, and you just can't play down the power of grace and the power of prayer. And I think it's going to have an effect. Maybe we're not going to see it immediately, although, you know, you do hear good stories about clinics closing or clinic workers deciding to leave because they're strengthened by this witness of people praying for them and praying in front of their clinics. So those would be, I think, the three key things to my mind.
Yeah, and I had done a story recently about the large number of abortion business workers who have been leaving that line of business, a lot of them connected with 40 Days for Life, but it certainly is a bright spot in this whole thing.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I remember when I first started working officially on pro-life stuff, that was when I started working for Father Frank Pavone, and I was living in Rome at the end of the 90s, and so I just was immersed in everything that he was doing, and the literature was just fascinating. I mean, just the testimonies of, you know, of abortion workers who had quit, and just imagine, I mean, they're wrestling with this. And Norma McCorvey's yeah. Book, I mean, she was one of the first to write a well-positioned book about working in a clinic and leaving it. And, you know, that was, I think Abby's book is wonderful and has followed up, I think, in a much stronger way. But if you read about the experience, or just listen, and a lot of it's not published, mm-hmm. the experience of people who've worked in clinics, this is not work that you go home feeling good about. And even if you don't have a clear conscience or a clear moral and ethical framework, it's very troubling. And I think it's, you know, you look at also the testimonies of some of the abortion doctors, and, you know, one of them, I remember, I think might have been Dr. Anthony Levitino, he mm-hmm. and his wife couldn't have children, they're trying to adopt, and doesn't realize that he's throwing away perfectly good babies every day.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard him speak, and it's quite an amazing testimony. You are listening to Register Radio. I am Tim Drake, and we are speaking with Dr. Padeh Soleni, a moral theologian and cultural analyst, and we are talking about the pro-life movement and whether it is indeed winning. You know, another thing that was mentioned in the Time magazine article was the role of technology, and that certainly has developed and certainly does play a role. I believe it's the case, isn't it, that where an expectant mother has the opportunity to see her unborn child, they overwhelmingly choose life. That's correct,
that's
isn't
correct.
It?
That's correct. And there was even a study that was done with women, expectant mothers, who were smoking. And when they saw an ultrasound, I think 90% of them quit smoking. And so the power of the ultrasound is very, very impactful because people see it's the reality. I mean, here's this little guy, and I've spoken with center directors who've worked with ultrasound and with patients, and it's, you know, these gals come in and they're being bombarded from all sides. They're under so much pressure, and it's when they look at that ultrasound that they're able to see clearly what the decision is that they're making.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the generational divide, because there clearly is a generational divide on this issue. And I'm wondering, you know, if you have some thoughts on why it is that this issue resonates with so many young people despite the millions of dollars that are poured into the abortion message by the culture, by Hollywood, pharmaceutical companies, Planned Parenthood, and yet the young overwhelmingly are pro-life, aren't they?
They are, but I think you kind of have to look at the context here. They are also overwhelmingly in favor of same-sex marriage. And I kind of call it—I call it the "no big deal" principle, or "what's the big deal?" I think that this is an effect of the culture of relativism, and so you know we do see there's no stigma around having a child out of wedlock. We have 40% of our births are to single moms, and that's as high as 70% in some demographics. All right, there's very little stigma around having a child out of wedlock. Celebrities do it. I mean, there are television shows promoting it and you know featuring it. I think that at the same time, and at the same time, we're seeing that the same generation has no problems with same-sex relationships, same-sex couples, same-sex marriage. I think it's because these things have been relativized for them, and in the world that is media entertainment, same-sex relationships are accepted, and a lot of people have a hard time distinguishing that world is different from reality. And so I think that in general, the moral bar has been lowered, and it's to our advantage on the pro-life issue. But I don't think I would not call it a moral awakening. I think it's just more of, well, what's the big deal? And I think that, you know, again, you can see the reality. We've got the technology that proves the humanity of this unborn child, and we don't have the same social stigmas around it.
That gets back to a question that I often ponder about and ask other folks to answer. So I'm going to ask you this question is, given that, what you just described, how is it that the catechism of the church can transform the catechism of the culture? You have any thoughts?
I do. I mean, first of all, just start talking about it. Start teaching it. You know, I was at World Youth Day Toronto 2002, and it was my first World Youth Day. And I was talking with some journalists, and they were kind of mocking the whole thing. They said, you know, look, you stop these kids, and nobody knows the church's teachings on sexuality, or if they do, they don't necessarily agree with them. You know, I mean, is this really such a big deal? I said, yeah, it is. I mean, they're here. That's what the big deal is. They are here to see this 80-year-old man, and they're being drawn by something bigger. And then you go into the experience of World Youth Day, which I'm sure you've had time and time again. And when you start seeing the bishops, I think you see them at their best teaching. People are eating it up. They're hungry for it. And so I think it's we just have to start talking about this. I mean, we keep talking about the new evangelization, but we're not quite sure what that looks like or what our specific goals are there. And we talk about it as if it's something separate from our day-to-day life in the church. And I think we just need to start talking about these truths and explaining them, because people are hungry and there is a receptiveness. The problem is that generally speaking, we're not giving them the meat. We're giving them this I don't know, this paste, this pablum. I mean, it's just we're not giving them the meat. We got to give people something to sink their teeth into. And you know, when I was in high school, the Mormon kids had seminary before high school every day, and they knew their faith, they knew their religion inside and out. All right. And, you know, the Catholic kids, I mean, we had youth group, and we were playing, you know, ridiculous games and passing a candle around a circle and talking about our feelings. We, you know, it may build up community, but it doesn't teach us anything about our faith. I had to go to college in order to learn something about my faith. So I think just start teaching it, start talking about it, and you know, from the pulpit, in our conversations. I think we're so worried about offending people, and so that gets down to, well, wait a minute, how do we talk to people, all right? And I like to make the point that when we talk about communication isn't just us talking and saying what we want to say. It's making sure that we're heard the way that we want to be heard. So then we have to think about, okay, I'm talking to this person, and I want them to hear the beauty of the church. I want them to hear the truth. Am I saying it in a way that they're going to hear it? If I'm being dogmatic, they might not hear it, you know? And in some cases, you do need to be hard, particularly in you know, cases of close relationships. But generally speaking, I don't think we need to be that hard on people. And rather, I think we need to invite people in. And, you know, I'm a fan of the Socratic method, asking people questions. Because if you ask people questions, they start to own it.
Sure. Well, Pia, I mean, we could talk about this the whole show, but unfortunately we're out of time. And so I want to thank you for joining us on Register Radio and for your insights.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much, Tim.
My thanks as well, Pia. And I want to mention your excellent website, piadesoleni.com, and that is spelled PIADESOLENNI.com. Did I get it right, Pia?
You did, and it's also, you can go to moraltheologian.com, and that will redirect.
Very good. And if anybody misses either one of those, they can send us an email, radio@EWTN.com. Thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. God bless.
When we return, we're going to talk about movies with Stephen Gray Donis. And this is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
Hello, I'm Michael Warsaw, Chief Executive of EWTN and publisher of the National Catholic Register. We're in a time in history like no other, and our fight for religious freedom and the need for the new evangelization, it's essential to stay connected via the faithful Catholic content delivered by the Register. We've finally been able to help realize Mother Angelica's dream. She always wanted a newspaper as part of EWTN's media apostolate. Why? Because there's an important catechetical opportunity at the intersection of faith and culture. Since the 1920s, the Register has been advancing the truth of the Magisterium. This valuable resource will help you to better understand the faith and deepen your relationship with our Lord. Join the growing ranks of Register subscribers today and access the one source of leading voices and opinions concerning the issues that matter most to you.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And we welcome you back to Register Radio. Along with Tim Drake, I'm Tom Price. Stephen Gray Donis serves as film critic for the National Catholic Register and for DecentFilms.com. Right now, he's in the midst of compiling his top 10 list for 2012. So we thought we would talk with Stephen today about his favorite films of the year just passed. Hey, Stephen, welcome back to Register Radio.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be back.
Stephen, this is Tim, and I know that you are in the midst of working on your article for the Register, and so I don't want to, reveal any information you don't want to reveal. But I did want to talk about the year for film. Did you feel it was a strong year, a weak year, somewhere in between in terms of film?
I think it was somewhere in between. You know, last year, 2011, was such a strong year. Some of the best films were among the most amazing films I've been privileged to review in my entire career at Decent Films. Of Gods and Men, of course. Fantastic true story about the martyrdom of Trappist monks in Algeria. A Separation, absolutely riveting family of marriage and divorce in Iran. This year was not a bad year, but it didn't have as strong as the films from last year, and so a little disappointing compared to last year.
Yeah, that was kind of the way I was feeling as well. But speaking of last year, and we did you did mention Of Gods and Men from 2011. Is there a film from last year, from 2012, that you found most spiritually edifying?
You know, there were a number of edifying films in 2012, a number of films that had significant religious and spiritual themes. Three in particular that warrant mention are Les Miserables, directed by Tom Hooper, who also did The King's Speech in 2010, one of the most overt uses of Catholic imagery in mainstream Hollywood cinema that we've seen in a long time. There were also a couple of independent films worth noting, For Greater Glory, the story of the Cristero War, and October Baby, a pro-life drama. But for me, the one outstanding, most spiritually edifying film of 2012 was a film called The Kid with a Bike. It's by a couple of filmmakers who are brothers, the Dardenne brothers, who were recently awarded the Robert Bresson Prize from the Pontifical Councils for Culture and Social Communications. This is a film prize which is given to filmmakers whose body of work really honors and explores the human search for spiritual meaning in life. And that's the kind of films that the Dardenne brothers have been making for many years now. And The Kid with the Bike is an extraordinary story about the significance of fatherhood and the impact of fatherlessness on the life of a young boy and who just needs his father to be more than he really is. As is all too often the case in our life, in our world. But it's also the story about how unexpected grace can pop into someone's life and how a person who is able to offer an unexpected and inexplicable yes to someone who is just getting no every direction that they turn, what a difference that can make. The Kid with a Bike is just a wonderful, wonderful film about moral goodness as well as the hard realities that so many children face growing up today.
Well, thanks. I had heard of that film, but had not seen it, so it's great. You also mentioned Les Mis, and I do want to ask this question because we have teens in the house who wanted to see that, and I've seen some conflicting reviews. Would you describe Les Mis as appropriate for families or not?
There is some body content in Les Mis that I would say would make it inappropriate for family audiences. I would say that middle teens and up, it's probably okay. There's nothing, you know, explicit or graphic, but there are a couple of rude images I wouldn't want to show to my kids or younger teens.
Is there a film that from 2012 that was the biggest surprise for you, and why?
Well, in terms of negative surprise, probably I was the most surprised by The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey. I was really hoping for more from Peter Jackson and company after The Lord of the Rings. The Lord of the Rings was a film of enormous highs and also some significant miscalculations. The Hobbit really accentuated those miscalculations and didn't really offer the same kinds of brilliant highs that we had seen in the previous films. For a positive surprise, I think I really enjoyed Aardman Animation's The Pirates Band of Misfits. It's such a nutty film, and it's something, it's the kind of thing that only British filmmakers are making. Just to have a pirate adventure in which you have Queen Victoria as a villain and Charles Darwin as a kind of nebbish sidekick is just kooky. You'd never get that from an American studio, and I love filmmakers who are willing to take risks and expect a little more, particularly of family audiences.
That's great. Yeah, speaking about The Hobbit, I think I had read maybe too many reviews, and so I went in with very negative expectations, and I came out actually slightly surprised by how much I did enjoy it. It did lag in a few scenes. I all along have disagreed with the fact that he was going to try to turn it into three films. It seems excessive to me, but I did enjoy the story overall. It did hold pretty closely to the book.
Yeah, it's not an awful film. The problem is just that he's trying too hard to compete with the impact of the earlier films. When you see the dwarves engaged in that incredibly scaled fight in Goblin Town, you know he's trying to compete with the Mines of Moria scene. And The Hobbit is a much smaller story. It shouldn't be competing with The Lord of the Rings. It's a shame that they had to make the films in the order that they did.
Yeah, and the other thing I was disappointed with in The Hobbit is that it is a children's story, and one that I've read to my children, but yet some of the violence in it really probably is not appropriate for my youngest children. So that was
disappointing. The film has a bit of a split personality. Some aspects of it are more childlike and appropriately so, but then when it comes to the action scenes, he ramps it right back up to those PG-13 levels.
Yeah. How about a pick for sort of a favorite indulgent, just for fun, popcorn film? Do you have one from the year?
Easy. Yeah, absolutely. The Avengers, Joss Whedon's superhero extravaganza. I don't think I had more fun at a movie this year. There are movies I admired more, movies that were, you know, more beautiful and that I am looking forward to seeing again more. But but that's partly because I've seen The Avengers about six times now. I went back to the theater again and again to see it, first with my sons and other friends, and then I went to see it with my wife. And then we watched it again when it came out on Blu-ray, and then I showed it to my daughter when she came home from college. Most fun that I had in the theaters all year, definitely The Avengers.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that, and I would agree. my last question, you know, a lot of the lists I've seen from 2012 seem to have Zero Dark Thirty and Moonrise Kingdom in the lists, and I was just curious whether you think either of those might make your list.
I admired both of those films, and one or both of them is probably going to be on my top 10. Zero Dark Thirty, I thought, for Catherine Bigelow, was a major step beyond her previous film, The Hurt Locker, and a really, really well-made film about the hunt of Osama bin Laden. And then Moonrise Kingdom, despite some troubling content, is, I think, Wes Anderson's best film, at least his most accessible film, and a film that really, I think, explores in a very touching way the young character's dissatisfaction with the way that marriage in their experience has been somewhat corrupted or defiled, and their desire for something purer and closer to what marriage is really supposed to be. A very touching film, and again, for a filmmaker who's been praised for his quirkiness, he manages to make that quirkiness accessible to a wider audience, and for that reason, also, I admire Moonrise Kingdom.
Well, Stephen, it is always a pleasure to have you on Register Radio, and I want to thank you for giving us a little sneak peek at your top 10 list. So thank you again.
Thank you, Tim.
And we always enjoy reading your stuff on ncregister.com, but of course it's all on decentfilms.com. That's the big site, right?
Well, that's where I do pull together all of my film writing, but it's not a bigger site than ncregister.com. There's a lot of people contributing there.
Very good.
Very happy to be a part of the mix.
Thank you so much. And don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Just look for the microphone icon to listen or download the show. Thanks again for joining us on Register Radio. For Tim, for all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Grow in your faith. At Seton Hall's Immaculate Conception Seminary School of Theology, you can earn a degree or certificate in theology, pastoral ministry, and more. Learn how at theology.shu.edu.